you're supporting the show, and that's a beautiful...
We are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio. And Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
Top Dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
This is Grant Lee Phillips telling you, if you're wondering where you're tuned to, it happens to be 88.3 FM, radio's finest. WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, we're the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's where things like this go. Right down the drain.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. Is Mark G of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Automation is the key. I am Dr. Jazz, PhD.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Now, it's E. Dueto from the Love Dogs, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh. The last bastion of pulchritude.
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yeah, well, this is Kimani Mali, and you're listening to WRCT FM. Keep it locked, Rasta.
This is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's Automation.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM.
Well, this is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know? Go Steelers.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you.
One's from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
If they had only waited till today, there would be now 40 or 41 people still alive in this universe of ours. They would not wait because these men were expendable. Guards, prisoners, had no meaning in the scheme of things of our white totalitarian world.
50 years ago today, New York State troopers raided the Attica State Prison in New York to violently put down a rebellion by prisoners. Through a haze of tear gas, police opened fire, killing 29 prisoners and 10 guards. A state cover-up of the mass killing began that day, September 13, 1971. We'll air long-suppressed testimony of Attica survivors who were tortured by guards.
Took me and they made me lay on the table in the yard and they beat me in my nuts. Threatened me and dropped cigarette butts on me and hot shells on me and spit on me.
We'll speak with three guests. Tyrone Lockins, a prisoner who survived the uprising. David Rothenberg, who went to Attica to negotiate on behalf of the prisoners. And Michael Hill, director of the new HBO Max documentary Betrayal at Attica. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States marked the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks with somber memorials across the country Saturday. Saturday's memorial service in New York began with a moment of silence at 8:46, the moment the first of the two planes struck the twin towers of the World Trade Center. Relatives then read the names of the victims of the attacks. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris were in attendance. Ahead of the memorial, Biden released a video message calling for national unity.
To the families of the 2,977 people from more than 90 nations killed on September 11th, 2001 in New York City, Arlington, Virginia, in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and the thousand more who were injured. America and the world commemorate you and your loved ones, the pieces of your soul. We honor all those who risked and gave their lives in the minutes, hours, months, and years afterwards.
Later on Saturday, Vice President Harris joined President Biden at the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
In America, our diversity is our strength. At the same time, we saw after 9/11 how fear can be used to sow division in our nation. As Sikh and Muslim Americans were targeted because of how they looked or how they worshipped.
Biden and Harris also visited Arlington, Virginia, to lay a wreath at the site of the 9/11 attack on the Pentagon. Meanwhile, the FBI has released the first of several previously classified documents examining connections between Saudi citizens and two of the 9/11 hijackers. The first document provided no conclusive links between prominent Saudis and the attackers Khalid al-Mindhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens, and families of 9/11 victims have long suspected senior Saudi officials provided funding and assistance for the attacks. Former President George W. Bush drew comparisons Saturday between 9/11 attackers and the Trump supporters who led the January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Bush spoke at the 9/11 memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home. But in their disdainful pluralism, in their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit, and it is our continuing duty to confront them.
The war is launched by Bush following 9/11, killed an estimated 929,000 people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere. That's according to the Cost of War Project, which estimates those wars came with a price tag of roughly $8 trillion. In related news, after an internal investigation, the U.S. Capitol Police Department is recommending disciplinary action in six cases for failures during the January 6 insurrection, but no criminal charges will be brought against officers. That includes one officer who was filmed posing for selfies alongside insurrectionists. Meanwhile, top security officials are expected to approve a request by the Capitol Police to reinstall fencing on Capitol Hill ahead of the far-right Justice for J6 rally next Saturday, organized by Trump supporters. Fencing erected after the insurrection was removed in July. In Afghanistan, the new Taliban government has said women will be permitted to study at universities, but that schools will be segregated. A dress code will be imposed and school curricula will be reviewed. Women and girls have been banned from schools and colleges under Taliban rule between 1996 and 2001. A recent UN report found the number of girls in elementary schools has increased from almost none to 2.5 million in the years after the Taliban lost power. The UN is reporting at least four people were killed during recent protests against Taliban rule and that the Taliban had conducted house-to-house searches for people who participated in the protests. The UN Human Rights Agency also warned of increasing intimidation and violence against journalists. Meanwhile, a New York Times investigation finds the U.S. drone strike that killed 10 people, seven of them children, in the final days of the military withdrawal from Afghanistan likely killed a worker for U.S. aid group and that there was no evidence of an ISIS bomb in the targeted vehicle. Zamaria Mahdi, who had applied for refugee resettlement in the United States, was likely transporting people to and from work. This all comes amidst a growing humanitarian and displacement crisis. Many Afghans who fled their towns for Kabul as the Taliban seized control are still living on city streets and in parks.
There was a war. There was bloodshed. Houses were destroyed. Children were orphaned. Women became widows. Because of these problems, everyone was displaced and came to Kabul.
A Florida appeals court has sided with Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, upholding his ban on school mask mandates while challenges are played out in lower courts. The ruling reverses a previous decision that had halted the ban. On Friday, the Education Department said it's looking into whether the Florida mask mandate ban was violating the rights of students with disabilities who are more vulnerable to severe infection from COVID-19. Similar investigations are underway in other states. Meanwhile, in Texas, Attorney General Ken Paxton said Friday he's suing at least six school districts that defied Governor Greg Abbott's order banning mask mandates at public schools. Here in New York City, around a million students are returning to school for in-person classes today for the first time in 18 months. As Pfizer-BioNTech is expected to seek approval soon for their COVID-19 vaccine for children 5 and older, new research by the Centers for Disease Control shows unvaccinated people are 11 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than vaccinated people, and more than 10 times more likely to be hospitalized. in Lebanon. A new government has been announced over 1 year after the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut, which killed over 200 people and led to the resignation of then Prime Minister Hassan Diab. Lebanon's richest man, Najib Mikati, will serve as prime minister, a post he's already held twice before. Lebanon is in the midst of growing social unrest and what the World Bank says is one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Authorities in southern Spain have evacuated 2,000 people from their homes in the Andalusian villages as a massive wildfire fanned by strong winds grew to some 15,000 acres. The fire is so large it spawned its own weather systems, with thick smoke creating pyrocumulus clouds that threatened to spark new fires with dry lightning strikes. Some evacuees had no time to gather up belongings as they fled.
This is inhuman. Nothing like this has ever been seen. The flames of the fire as they ran through the mountains, it was spectacular.
Last month, the region recorded Spain's all-time high temperature record of 117 degrees Fahrenheit. In California, thousands of firefighters are battling at least a dozen large fires whipped up by high winds and fueled by bone-dry vegetation. Much of California remains under a heat advisory through the end of the week. Fire officials say this year's season is on pace to equal or top 2020's record fire season. In the Pacific, Super Typhoon Shansu struck the northern Philippines Saturday before grazing Taiwan and bringing strong winds and heavy rain to eastern China. At its peak, the storm was the equivalent of an extremely dangerous Category 5 hurricane with sustained winds of 160 miles per hour. Parts of the Texas coast are under a hurricane watch as Tropical Storm Nicholas is forecast to gain in intensity ahead of its landfall late today. Meanwhile, torrential monsoon rains in northern Pakistan triggered landslides and destroyed homes Sunday, leaving at least 17 people dead. A record number of environmentalists, land and water defenders, were assassinated in 2020, with advocates in the global south disproportionately targeted with violence. That's according to an annual report by Global Witness, which documented at least 227 environmental activists were murdered last year. More than a third of the killings involved indigenous leaders. Colombia, Mexico, the Philippines, and Brazil recorded the most murders as local communities resist mines, deforestation, and other destructive industries that contribute to the climate crisis. The report says, quote, "As the climate crisis deepens, forest fires rampage across swaths of the planet, drought destroys farmland, and floods leave thousands dead. The situation for frontline communities and defenders of the earth is getting worse," they said. In Brazil, indigenous women led a protest in the capital, Brasilia, Friday, ahead of a much-anticipated Brazilian Supreme Court decision that could undermine thousands of indigenous people if thousands of indigenous people can reclaim stolen ancestral lands. If the High Court rules against indigenous communities, rights defenders warn it could worsen an onslaught of aggressive mining on sacred land.
"We are here to join the fight. They've invaded our territories, and now they're in the hands of agriculturists and large-scale landowners. We are here to reclaim our territory."
The New York Times reports Guinean soldiers are being trained by U.S. Army Special Forces last weekend when they staged a coup that ousted the former president Alpha Conde, replacing him with a military leader. The U.S. has denied involvement in the coup despite training those who carried it out. Guinea holds major mineral deposits, including gold, iron, ore, and bauxite, and China is its biggest trading partner. Last week, the Economic Community of West African States suspended Guinea following the military coup. In Burma, at least 20 people have been killed in a new wave of violent clashes between militias and Burmese security forces following the February military coup that ousted the country's democratically elected government. Since the coup, at least 1,080 people have been killed by the military junta and over 6,000 arrested. This week, the United Nations is holding its 76th General Assembly, where it could decide whether Burma's junta or its civilian government will be recognized for a seat at the UN. The United Nations Atomic Agency and Iran said they reached a deal Sunday to allow international inspectors into some of Iran's nuclear sites and to reset equipment for monitoring them. The two parties also said they'll continue talks about Iran's nuclear program. The development means Tehran will likely avoid censure by the agency and renewed hope that the 2015 nuclear deal could still be restored. The U.S. has unilaterally withdrawn from the landmark deal in 2018 under President Trump. North Korea says it's carried out tests on strategic long-range cruise missiles, which can travel as far as 930 miles. The announcement came just ahead of a meeting between nuclear envoys from South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. to discuss North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Back in the U.S., President Biden's campaigning in California today, alongside Governor Gavin Newsom, one day before voting ends in a right-wing recall vote to remove Governor Newsom from office. His main challenger is conservative talk radio host Larry Elder, who wants to repeal COVID public health measures, does not believe in combating climate change, and was a mentor to Trump's xenophobic advisor Stephen Miller. And in Chile, thousands took to the streets of Santiago Saturday to mark the 48th anniversary of the U.S.-backed military coup on September 11, 1973, against the democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende. Allende was killed that day as Chilean armed forces bombed and stormed the presidential palace, unleashing a brutal dictatorship under Augusto Pinochet for the next 17 years. Protesters also marched to Santiago's main cemetery to honor the victims of Pinochet's dictatorship.
I come to this march every year because of the large amount of comrades and friends that were annihilated by the fascist coup of September 11, 1973. Dozens and dozens of people who I knew from university, from my job, and who are still missing today or were killed by the scoundrels in uniform.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, 50 years ago today, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller called out state troopers who opened fire on an Attica prison uprising, killing 39 people. The ultimate dead tally, 10 guards, 29 prisoners. Today, we air long-suppressed testimony of Attica survivors who were tortured by guards and speak with one of the Attica brothers, a negotiator and a filmmaker who helped uncover what really happened. Stay with us. Attica Blues by Archie Shepp. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we spend the hour marking the 50th anniversary of the deadliest prison uprising in the history of the United States. A state cover-up of the mass killing began that day. We will air long-suppressed testimony of survivors who were tortured by guards and speak with one of the survivors, as well as a negotiator and a filmmaker who helped uncover what really happened. And a warning to our listeners and viewers, today's show will include graphic, painful, brutal descriptions and images. Yes, 50 years ago today, September 13th, 1971. New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller waged war on the men held in Attica State Prison in western New York, ending a four-day prisoner uprising. The rebellion started on September 9, 1971, when prisoners overpowered guards and took over much of Attica to protest the conditions at the maximum security prison. At the time, prisoners spent most of their time in their cells and got one shower per week. Days of tense negotiations followed in the prison yard. The rebellion was on its way to being resolved through diplomacy. But on the morning of September 13th, Governor Rockefeller ordered state troopers to storm the prison. Through a haze of tear gas, police opened fire, killing 29 prisoners and 10 hostages. Three prisoners and a guard were killed by prisoners in the days before the retaking. In all, there were 43 deaths. This is a trailer for the new documentary called Betrayal at Attica on HBO Max that examines the hidden history of what really happened in the Attica uprising through the men who lived it, the Attica brothers, and their defense attorney, Elizabeth Fink, who died in 2015. The film draws on an archive of evidence that was once owned by Liz Fink, available now for the first time.
I stole all this stuff. I shouldn't say that. I expropriated it from them as the chief counsel for the prisoners who were the plaintiffs. Going to destroy it. We're at this point right now where they are refusing to admit they have all these files and they are lying about what they have. It's all going to be blown up because I took it all and also because of you.
In the documentary Betrayal at Attica, prisoners describe how they were tortured when the uprising was brutally suppressed. These are actually deposition interviews from the 1974 civil suit against the state of New York filed by the Attica brothers' legal defense. In this clip, Frank Big Black Smith, who became a spokesperson of the prisoners and helped protect the hostages as well, describes what happened to him. A warning. His answer and the images that accompany it are graphic, brutal, emotional.
I was made to crawl after I was knocked to the ground, pushing, kicking, calling me all kinds of shit, telling me to walk, telling me to run, drug, drag.
Where did they take you?
They took me to
Your
under my chin, yes.
All day?
Yes.
All day?
Yes.
shell ground on your chest?
Oh, no, I move and try and get them off me, and the cigarettes off me. A bunch of times being beat, calling a bunch of names because my legs was dead. There was numb. I couldn't walk. They finally drugged me and threw me in the hallway, and I had to go through the same thing everybody else was going through because I was about the last person out of the yard. They made me run through a gully.
That was Frank Big Blacksmith, who survived the brutal state suppression of the 1971 Attica uprising 50 years ago today. In a clip from the new documentary, Betrayal at Attica, which brings to light new evidence about what really happened, Big Black said the officers put a football under his chin and told him if it dropped, they would kill him. He went on to fight for justice in a civil suit for prisoners and also push for compensation for the guards' families. Big Black died in 2004. For more, we're joined by Tyrone Larkins. He was incarcerated in upstate New York's Attica prison at the time of the uprising. He was 23 years old. He was shot three times. After 29 years of incarceration, Tyrone was released via parole in 1997 with a college education through Marist College. He's also featured in a Showtime documentary, brand new, called Attica by Stanley Nelson, which just premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival. Tyrone Larkins, welcome to Democracy Now! This is a painful time, I'm sure, for you, even now, half a century later. Can you start off even before September 9th, 1971, when the prisoner rebellion began, and describe the prison conditions at Attica and the political climate at the time? What led to this uprising?
Give me a second. Hearing the overview of Frank's voice and what happened, it took me back 50 years ago today. Let's make note that this happened exactly 50 years ago today on a Monday morning. And as I was on my way to where I was going to do this taping at, I seen a cloudy sky, and it reminded me of September 13th, 1971. I'm a little discombobulated now, but I am ready to go. And your question was, how did it all start? Am I correct?
Yes. How did it all start even before September 9th, the beginning of the prisoner uprising?
Okay. I got to Attica. I was transferred to Attica in January 1971 from Sing Sing, Ossining, which is known now as Ossining Correctional Facility. And when I got into Attica, I seen that this was, from the time I got off the bus, me and about 40 other people that was transferred, seen that this was the roughest place I've ever seen in my life. The only time the prison guard spoke to us was to give us a description of the institution, to tell us when they bang on the wall once with their stick, it means go. And when they bang on the wall with their stick twice, it means to stop. And that basically was the extent of the conversation. You can feel the roughness and the tightness of the facility in the air. After coming from Sing Sing, which was relatively, I wouldn't say open, but a little more humane. When I finally got settled into the facility at my cell, I was given a roll of toilet paper, a bar of soap, and was told that this roll of toilet paper would have to last me for 1 month, and that I will possibly get a second bar of soap in 2 weeks' time. And that was it. I should say at this juncture that Attica, prior to the disturbance itself, and I use the word disturbance loosely, because we was in the climate of international things that was happening throughout the world. First of all, from ethnic pride sense, a lot of the African-American prisoners, such as myself, adhered to what James Brown was saying, and say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. That gave us a racial identity as opposed to be adhering to what a nigger is and stop doing what niggers do. And that made us feel good. Then you had the hell no, we won't go slogans was permeating all over the world in regards to the Vietnam situation. So we was getting a certain sense of politicalization and ethnic reality at the same time. And we started adhering to things of that nature. And this was counterculture to the powers that be in Attica Correctional Facility. And to give you an example of that, the first time I seen it fully in full operational, you know, the racial divide, was in the summer of 1971. It was a hot day, and the officers came out into the yard. I was locking in B block at the time, and had a wheelbarrow full of ice, and emptied the wheelbarrow full of ice on the ground and said, white ice, which meant that that ice was for the white prisoners. And after they picked their ice up, a second wheelbarrow was rolled to the yard, and the officers dumped it on the ground and said, black ice. And that was for the black and, well, let me say people of color, prisoners that was locked up in Attica at the time. And this caused a definite racial divide. However, I would say in later part of June, early part of July, when ice was strewn on the ground and it was depicted white ice and black ice, nobody in the yard would pick it up, nor white inmates, nor black inmates, nor Hispanic inmates, nor Indian inmates. Nobody would pick up any ice that was depicted for a racial of people. As a matter of fact, the fact that the ice was strewn on the ground as opposed to being left in the wheelbarrow was an insult in itself. In June, excuse me, ratcheting it up to the end of July, August, I should say, pardon me, when George Jackson was killed, was murdered, as we would like to call it, in San Quentin prison, on the so-called information that he had a gun in his ear and was trying to escape, that created a unified concern for basically everybody that was in Attica. As a matter of fact, the day after he was killed, it was organized that everybody in the facility would not eat. We had a hunger strike. We went to the mess hall as we were supposed to, picked up the silverware or plastic silverware as they gave out, but nobody picked up any food. And it was extremely quiet. You didn't hear no noise, no chatter, no nothing. And it was when it was time to go, we left out of the facility, the eating facility, which was known as the mess hall. On September 8th, 1971, two guys that was locked up was horsing around in the yard, in a block yard. And the officers rushed over to them to threaten them to stop it, so forth, etc. And a circle of inmates, a gathering of inmates, got around the officers and said, you're not doing anything to anybody. And they backed off. Well, later on that night, the two men who was horsing around was literally dragged out of their cells and was beaten all the way to a special housing unit. And you could hear the cries throughout a block yard. Well, The next day, September 9th, the guys that was coming from, that was on the same jail company or housing company where these two guys was pulled out of, was coming back from the mess hall, and they was told that they was not going to the yard for the morning recreation. They was going back to the cell blocks. And that was the spark that started the whole thing. And they took control of A Block, and they took control basically of the facility. I personally was locking in B Block and was working in the metal shop. And the next thing I know, I seen guys from A Block, B Block, C Block in the metal shop. And I knew it was a full scale, what do we call it, a prison riot. But let me say that it elevated from a prison riot to a prison demonstration. And I know those words, sometimes people will not like to interchange it, but it was, because the mere fact that we as people that was confined took on the situation of electing our best and our brightest to represent us, to talk to the administration of the powers that be of the problems in Attica, and that we had some hostages also. And we adhered to all the factors that was involved. There was no problem in that yard. And sooner rather than later, we had observers come in, because we asked for people from the outside to come into the prison itself. And their level of participation ratchet up from being an observer to being our negotiators with the powers that be. Well, now, we know that didn't work out too well because of what happened on Monday, this Monday, 50 years ago, exactly on a Monday, the 13th, September 13th, 1971. I woke up in the morning after a fitful night of sleep because a mist and a rain came, and it was a mist and a rain over the yard that morning. And the next thing I know, I guess it was 8:30, 9 o'clock, I heard a big helicopter hovering, and I seen it hovering over the yard, and the announcement came, put your hands on your head, lay down, you will not be harmed. And there was some gas that they released from this helicopter that literally knocked me to my knees, and it cleaned my sinuses out. But at the same token, the ground all around me was jumping and shaking. And I'm thinking I was in some type of a movie or something, but what was jumping and all around me was bullets. And I took three shots. And I fell out, but then I regained my consciousness. Somebody, either was a correction officer or a state trooper, was kicking me in my side, and I was told, get up and start crawling, and let's go to the exit to A Block door. And once I got literally thrown into A Block yard by correction officers or National Guardsmen or state troopers, I don't know who it was. I was thankful to see that there was people with stretchers that came and grabbed me by the nape of my neck and pulled me out of a crowd of other individuals who was laying on top of me and on the side of me, and put me on a stretcher and took me out the yard.
Tyron,
I'm sorry.
We thought at this moment we would play a clip from Betrayal at Attica, which is the actual video depositions of prisoners like yourself and what happened to them after the state troopers opened fire, killing 39 men, among them prisoners and guards. These clips are extremely graphic, and so are the images it shows.
In 1974, Attica Brothers Legal Defense filed a $2.8 billion civil suit against the state of New York for damages on behalf of 1,281 inmates. After years of delay by the appointed judge, pretrial discovery depositions got underway in 1991. These tapes are from that deposition. They have never been available to the public.
George Alexander Schultz, Jr. Recall where you were on the morning of September 13, 1971?
Yes.
Go away. In Attica's prison.
I was hit.
I was kicked in the side, the back, and the buttocks.
My head was in the dirt.
I was kicked in the side, I was kicked in the hip, kicked in the back.
Any inmates being kicked in a yard?
I don't recall that.
I was hit in testicles.
By what?
On a shotgun.
Tell me about how many times you feel you were hit during that.
I couldn't really say. All I knew, I was hit. I was hit, what? You know, when you're hit like that, you're not trying to count. You know, you're scared to death. I wet it on myself. I was hit in the head, the back, my arms, trying to block, and the lip.
Lip?
Face, yes.
Did you wear glasses at that time?
Yes, I did.
Did you have them on?
No, they had taken them to and stomped on.
Then my glasses was taken off me, stomped.
You were forced under gunpoint to crawl the length of the yard on your knees and elbows.
I was told to take off all of my clothes. I was hit and told to run.
They put the gun in my head, cocked the gun, and said, I'm going to kill you. And that's when I started pleading for my life.
There was a correction, two correctional officers there telling me the same thing. Run, run. And that's exactly what I did.
And I was told when I hit this door with this stick, you better start moving. And when he hit the door, I started moving.
Did you hear what kind of language was being uttered in that yard?
Emphatic language, get over there, get down, move along, that sort of thing.
Did it have after it words such as and you said, get down there?
No, I didn't hear that. If I did, I'd report it to you.
So these were testimony and depositions. Tyrone Larkin's, it is utterly painful. And in the documentary, Betrayal at Attica, it goes on and on what happened to these men. And, of course, also your story that we're hearing today.
Yes. Yes. After going to the hospital, well, actually, I laid on the stretcher with quite a few individuals in the yard that was between the giant wall, the hospital, and special housing unit. And as I was coming in and out of consciousness, because the pain was great, I seen a line of men that was being escorted or ran like cattle and being beaten by sticks naked going to a special housing unit, which is called HBZ. And at the last one I seen one guy, he fell, and a bunch of correction officers was over him and beating him until he got up and continued to run. I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional and my words maybe get a little jumbled because I'm going directly back 50 years. And then I was taken to the hospital. And I thank God for that because the medical personnel that took care of me, it was a doctor, I forget his name. I know he mentioned it. And he said he was from Myra Memorial Hospital. And he told me, look, I'm going to try to fix you up, but let me look at the extent of your wounds and see what can be done to see if you need to go to the outside hospital or if I can do local procedures here. Well, I guess he felt that he can do the local procedures there and in Attica because I was taken immediately up to the hospital ward. And they started the preliminary examinations, things of that nature, and started the repairing or the rebuilding of myself.
Tyron Larkins, we're going to break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by one of the negotiators. Many believe if the negotiators had been able to continue their work without New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller calling on the state troopers to open fire, this could have resolved peacefully. Tyron Larkins, formerly incarcerated at Attica Prison, was shot by state troopers 50 years ago today, September 13, 1971. We'll also speak with the HBO Max documentary filmmaker of the film Betrayal at Attica. Stay with us. State by Yoko Ono and John Lennon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're spending the hour marking the 50th anniversary of the deadliest prison uprising in the history of the United States, speaking with a formerly incarcerated survivor who was shot several times by state troopers. In a minute, we'll be joined by one of the negotiators who were brought in by the prisoners and the filmmaker who helped uncover the evidence of what really happened. A warning again that today's show includes graphic, painful descriptions and images. This clip from the new HBO Max documentary, Betrayal at Attica, shows how misinformation spread about how the hostages who were killed during the Attica uprising actually died. This is New York prison system spokesman Gerald Houlihan saying this hostages had their throats slashed. And then the county medical examiner, Dr. John Edlund, who contradicts him. But first, we hear from attorneys Liz Fink and Bill Kunstler.
If they had only waited till today, there would be now 40 or 41 people still alive in this universe of ours. They would not wait because these men were expendable. Guards, prisoners, had no meaning in the scheme of things of our white totalitarian world.
How did they kill them?
7 minutes.
Well, several had their throats slashed. I don't have all the details on it. I understand one had a chest wound that he died from, and I don't have all of those details.
When you read the front page of the New York Times, it's a scream. It is. I mean, they have them fighting hand by hand in the blocks for 4 hours.
The press accepted Houlihan's report of slashed throats, but the next day, county medical examiner John Edlund announced the truth.
The first 8 autopsies were on the cases identified to us as hostages. All 8 cases died of gunshot wounds.
He was this conservative Republican, and he was a doctor. So, you know, they brought all these bodies to him. And he says, oh, these were all shot. You know, nobody, what are you talking about?
There was no evidence of slashed throats. There was one single cut in the back of one of the necks.
And they totally attacked him and destroyed him, actually.
And this is another clip from Betrayal at Attica. On the night of September 13, 1971, 50 years ago today, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller called President Nixon to update him on the retaking of Attica. Their conversation was recorded on the same machines that brought down Nixon's corrupt administration 3 years later. This is part of their call.
I know you've had a hard day, but I want you to know that I just back you to the hilt. The courage you showed and the judgment in not granting amnesty, it was right, and I don't care what the hell the papers or anybody else says. I don't care what they say. I think that you had to do it that way, because if you would have granted amnesty in this case, it would have meant that you would have had prisons and an uproar all over this country.
That's right.
And you did the right thing. It's a tragedy that these poor fellows are shot, but I just want you to know that's my view, and I pulled the troops around here there to back that right to the hilt.
Well,
aren't you great, Mr. President? I only called you because I wanted to alert you that we were going in. And
right.
When we went in, we couldn't tell whether all 39 hostages would be killed and maybe 200 or 300 prisoners.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty big,
boy.
You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They did a fabulous job.
How many? I only got the report this morning. What is the latest report? How many
seven
people?
Seven hostages were killed.
Seven hostages were killed.
These were the guards.
Those are guards, seven.
It appears now, Mr. President, as though quite a few of those were killed prior to this. In other words, that they'd been dead.
One, you can prove that, can't you? I mean,
this is the hospital.
The hospital can prove that.
Oh, yeah.
They can find out how long guys dead.
That's right. And it's a Catholic hospital, so it's outside of our jurisdiction.
Right. So tell me this. Are these primarily blacks that you're dealing with?
Oh, yes. The whole thing was led by the blacks.
I'll be darned. Are all the prisoners that were killed blacks? Are there any whites?
I haven't got that report, but I have to. I would say just offhand, yes.
Yeah.
We did it, though, only when they were in the process of murdering the guards or when they were attacking our people as they came in to get the guards.
You had to do it.
And otherwise, we recaptured all the cell blocks and so forth without shooting a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And no troopers were wounded. One of them was in the leg.
Mm-hmm.
But
only one trooper was wounded. Good.
That's right.
Good.
It really was
good.
A beautiful operation.
Well, they must.
It really was a beautiful operation, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller said on that day. In fact, Nelson Rockefeller would then become vice president under President Ford. For more, we're joined by David Rothenberg, a member of the Attica Observers Committee. He was one of 35 people brought into Attica to negotiate on behalf of prisoners. He's founder of the Fortune Society, which was relatively new at the time of the uprising, that helped people who got out of prison reintegrate into society. Also with us, Michael Hull, director of the new HBO documentary film Betrayal at Attica, that plays this conversation between President Nixon and then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller. David Rothenberg, your thoughts on what happened and why, when you were negotiating with so many others between the prisoners and the state, Rockefeller decided to simply have the troopers open fire.
Amy, we were brought in as observers. The inmates were the negotiators. As it went along, some of the observers, like Bill Kunstler and Congressman Badillo and Tom Wicker, were a little more sophisticated than people like myself who were new in this whole arena, and they were giving advice. But what had happened is, in the takeover, you said earlier that one of the guards had been beaten up and two of the inmates in the takeover, and Officer Quinn, during the negotiations, the word came out that Officer Quinn had died. And that changed the whole tone of the negotiations because amnesty was taken off the table. But the irony of that for me, and I always say this, I brought nothing to what happened in the yard that day. I was an observer. What I came away with was life-changing, because what the state did is they went in and killed, as we learned, nine of the hostages. They wouldn't continue the negotiations because one guard had died, but they then killed the hostages. And, you know, years later, a man named Malcolm Bell, who was hired by the state to investigate all of what was Attica, suddenly had a press conference and said, the state's been lying through the whole time.
And he was a Republican.
He was a conservative Republican, wrote a book called The Turkey Trot, and we started communicating, and he was giving us chapter and verse. But I think one of the most significant things about all of this, beyond just Attica, because Attica is all of us, has become a motto, is every time I talk about Attica, there's always someone that reminds me, well, these men had committed serious crimes, and they were dangerous, et cetera. The irony in our prison system, and Attica is almost the epitome of it, is that people went in there, having been charged and convicted of serious crimes, they went into an atmosphere that nurtured the very behavior that got them in there. There was nothing in Attica or in much of the prison system around the country that gave people an opportunity to confront why they are there and what they could do to lessen the possibility when they go back to the communities. And Attica was, Tyrone, and Tyrone should be thanked for continuing to be a voice for those who are no longer here to tell the story, that you don't go into a place and be given one roll of toilet paper a month and feel disgusting about yourself. Well, you're going in with self-negated feelings to begin with, and they do everything in the institution. And when Tyrone talked about those sticks that they stop and go with, they were called, I can't say the word, the end stick. The guards called them the end sticks, and they nurtured the hostility. And the other thing was on the takeover, there was, I know at least one white inmate died because two people were killed after the takeover because they were targeted. One was Sam Melville and the other was L.D. Barkley. Barkley, because he had been on the news coverage when the cameras went in, had been such an articulate spokesperson for the inmate perspective. And Sam Melville was targeted because he had been a political weatherman and had helped with some of the black inmates like Roger Champion and Herbert X. Blyden to break down the differences. The inmates were kept, as Tyrone pointed out, inmates were always kept apart. That's how they kept control, pitting white against black with Puerto Ricans in the middle. People like Herbert Blyden and Roger Champion and Sam Melville, black and white, said together we're stronger, we can affect change, to improve the conditions, to create opportunities, to have education programs. That was threatening to an institution that only knew how to run by punishment. And so the Attica, the event itself is almost a microscopic view of the failure of our criminal justice system and an all-prison system.
And that conversation between President Nixon and then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller?
Well, I've always, the Attic Observers Committee met weekly at Bill Kunstler's house. And one of the things that I've clearly come to the conclusion is that Nelson Rockefeller was making choices as he was reconstructing his political image. The Rockefeller drug law, which followed soon after, he wanted to run for president. He was perceived as an Eastern liberal. He was reconstructing. This was calculated. And so the decision to send in troops was all part of the plan to begin with. And it was decided, as Herman Badillo told us, that they waited till Monday morning because they were afraid there would be unrest in the ghetto, as they described it, if they went in on Sunday. So they waited till Monday morning, and they could have taken over the institution with the gas, with the mace, and never shot a single bullet. But that was Herman Badillo and Tom Wicker were on the phone with Rockefeller on Sunday night imploring. And that's when Herman said, there's always a time to die, which became the title of Tom Wicker's book. Wicker was a columnist for the Times, and he and Herman had a lot of sway and power and had access to Rockefeller. And they pleaded with him, give us more time to talk. And the choice was political. It was made in Albany. It wasn't made at Attica at all. It was a political decision.
I want to bring Michael Hull into the conversation. This new HBO Max documentary, Betrayal at Attica, is horrifying. As you use archival footage, some of it never before known, and also the lies, the cover-up. I mean, you have David mentioning the conservative Republican investigator writing a book ultimately about what he found, and that book called The Attica Turkey Shoot, Carnage, Cover-Up, and the Pursuit of Justice by Malcolm Bell. And, of course, you hear Tyrone talking about, in our last segment, Tyrone Larkins talking about what happened. Why was it so important for you to make this film, Michael?
I spent a lot of time with Liz Fink, and Liz had preserved this archive. The state of New York has been saying for 50 years that this evidence doesn't exist, that it was destroyed, whatever the case may be. And the state police conducted the retaking of the prison. They also conducted the investigation of themselves. So they started destroying and obfuscating evidence on September 13th, 1971. And Liz managed to find this evidence, and she used some of it in the civil trials that she was, kind of the leader of. And she, the state of New York continued to act like this evidence didn't exist, and the evidence proves exactly what she said all along. And, what David and Tyrone have said, they planned this thing and they did exactly what they planned. They wanted a massacre. And Liz always felt like it was intended to stop protest in this country. She felt like they were tired of all the protests that had been taking place, and they were not trying to see protests move into the prison space, and they felt like they could murder these men and get away with it. And it was more important to stop this rebellion and make their point than it was even to protect their own employees. You know, it wasn't just inmates who were murdered. They murdered their own employees, and all of them were citizens of the state of New York. All of them were supposed to be looked after in one way or another by the governor, and he chose to kill them instead. And so for them to carry all of this out in such a cynical and manipulative kind of way, and then to just act like it didn't exist or it never happened, you know, Liz was very offended, you know, and she was
and
an
ultimately
organizer,
won
and she organized me.
$12 million settlement for the prisoners. And Frank Big Black Smith would also fight for a settlement for the workers, for the prison guards as well. We have 10 seconds, Michael.
Liz wanted to make sure that everybody could see this evidence because she knew that if people could see it, they would never believe the lies of the state of New York again. So it's been my charge to make sure it's available to people. And all of the evidence is online at AticaMassacres.com as well as in the film.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Michael Hull, director of the new HBO Max documentary, Betrayal at Attica, not to be missed. I want to also thank David Rothenberg, one of the Attica observers and founder of the Fortune Society. And, of course, Tyrone Larkins, formerly incarcerated at Attica, survived despite being shot by state troopers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Doug Henwood to talk about a recent article he wrote on the ruling class.
Who rules America? The most important question. Listen in, because Doug Henwood knows a lot about the answer.
Julian Assange's father, John Shipton, joins us with an update on his son's case.
John Shipton has been touring the United States trying to save the life of his son, Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. In 1915, the great Irish socialist James Connolly said, "Oh yes, the ruling class are worthy of study. The natural history of the ruling class is a fascinating interest. You begin with interest, you proceed with awe and admiration, you deepen into hatred, and you wind up with contempt for the nature of the beast. You realize that the capitalist class is the meanest class that ever grasped the reins of power." Jacobin Magazine's spring 2021 issue is devoted entirely to an examination of the ruling class. We speak today with Doug Henwood, who has an article in Jacobin entitled, "Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class." Doug Henwood is the editor of Left Business Review and the host of the radio program Behind the News. Doug Henwood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Always good to be here.
Doug, we need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. Who holds power now, and has this changed over the last 50 or 100 years?
Well, that's a pretty long topic, but I would say, in general, the ruling class society consists of it's not just doesn't map easily onto the very rich. A lot of the very rich are just not that politically engaged or politically thoughtful. And certainly the preferences of the corporate class and Wall Street matter politically, but they also have to articulate with a political class that engages with the state and in political parties, the business wing of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is a problematic little assembly, so we can talk about that maybe a little bit later. But much of our politics does reflect the interest of the very rich, but they can't always articulate it directly, so they need a political class to develop an agenda for them. So elite politicians, Trump certainly did not qualify, but Obama certainly did. But also there's a kind of permanent political class of pundits and people who go in and out of government and the private sector. The famous revolving door, where people go from lobbying to corporate positions to high government positions where they hand out favors and contracts and deregulate and do all those kinds of things that make businesses very happy. So, yeah, I think this partnership between the very rich but with a political class that really makes their rule possible. What's changed over the years is that there was once a much more coherent elite in the country, the old WASPs that ran things essentially from the founding of the country through probably the mid-70s, late 70s. They were, in just a sociological sense, a much more coherent formation than what we have now. They went to the same schools. They married out of the same pool. They belonged to the same clubs. They summered in the same vacation spots. Now it's a much more, divided by business sector,